Chapter 1. Sensitive. On the second floor of the White Cape Cod, I am lying in my three-quarter blue antique bed, surrounded by knotty pine walls, reading the book Life After Life, found at my favorite childhood library. It contained true stories of people who had near-death experiences. Often, while staring up at the multicolored flowered wallpaper on the ceiling, I contemplated no longer existing. There was only nothingness before my birth. I figured it must be the same after death, just floating in the void. In Life After Life, people had died and traveled to the other side. Later revived by medical treatment, they would share what they experienced while clinically dead. I found these stories deeply fascinating, and they provided an alternate belief system than the one I had learned about in Sunday school. A regular church attender, I had refused to be confirmed with the rest of the kids my age. I did not understand why this ritual was necessary or what it meant for my future. It was one of my earliest memories of refusing to follow the crowd. "How do we know that we are right about our religion?" I asked my mom, looking for certainty where none existed. She must have soothed my worried mind enough to convince me to follow through with confirmation the following year. But there was always something missing for me with religion. There was also something missing as it pertained to my adoption. An air of mystery surrounded my origins. With feet straight up resting on the slope of the roof, I often wondered how I ended up in this family. A naturally inquisitive and precocious child, I asked many questions my parents had no answers to. "She was the happiest baby at the cradle," was a refrain I had heard often growing up. The cradle, I had known since before I could remember, was the place my parents adopted me from. Always skeptical, I knew there had to be more to the story, and I needed to get to the bottom of it. A very outspoken child, I announced to my kindergarten teacher one day that I lived in a cradle. I also started a big ruckus when I told my second grade teacher I did not come out of my mommy's tummy. That teacher, of course, did not believe me, even going so far as to call my mother. That was a big mistake on her part, because Rachel let her have it when the teacher admitted to not reading the paperwork she had requested the parents fill out, paperwork which clearly outlined my adoption status. So I knew I was adopted, yet there was so much I did not know. Who were the people who created me, and why didn't they keep me? Why can't I see their faces? In her book, Journey of the Adopted Self, Betty Jean Lifton refers to this as the telling without telling. Telling without telling means that parents feel their duty is complete by informing their child of their adoption status. Yet, what many parents are unwilling to do is commit to learning more about their child's background and providing support when their child needs answers. Being purposefully not in the know allows parents to claim, "We just don't know," when their child is showing signs of needing and wanting to know more. I was often labeled negatively in my family because of my strong will and was referred to as bossy. I was an open book about my adoption status, never considering that I might be better off hiding this fact. This telling people I was adopted went on until I hit middle school, which I hated with every fiber of my being. I had a group of nerdy friends, but once they figured out I was adopted, the ringleader decided I was weird. She, too, called up my mother when she didn't believe I was adopted. She, too, got an earful. Eventually, this resulted in me writing "bitch" on the bathroom walls about her, the start of my public writing journey. It was the first time I got into big-time trouble at school. My punishment was to scrub said bathroom walls. During most of my childhood in the 70s, Rachel was a stay-at-home mom. If I had to compare her to someone famous, it would be Martha Stewart. She definitely lived up to the supermom image, which was not uncommon amongst friends and neighbors' moms. Finding it frivolous to pay anyone else for work she could do herself, she wallpapered, sewed, mowed, gardened, canned, baked, and painted. A world traveler before she met my dad, Max, and fiercely independent, she modeled self-sufficiency, organization, and cleanliness. Marie Kondo would approve. While my dad was out of town for his work, my mom taxied my brother and I to different activities. These included ballet, gymnastics, acting, soccer, swim team, disco dancing, choir, private violin lessons, and orchestra. My mom never missed a game or a concert. Being raised by a perfectionist, most everything about me was seen as a self-improvement project and was open for commentary. My hair, weight, friends, boyfriends, clothing, and how I ate. I desperately wanted to be seen and heard for the person that I knew that I was, but who was I really? "You rarely showed emotion as a child," Rachel would later say to me as an adult. I find this interesting, considering that most of my memories surrounding emotional events in my childhood were swept under the rug. I was trained to believe and act like everything was fine, even when it wasn't. My brother Scott, adopted from the cradle 3 years after me, once called me a, quote, sheep following the herd. Maybe compared to him, I look like a sheep. As a young child, he was sweet and compliant, but as a teenager, he became increasingly more rebellious, keeping a ladder on the roof of the house so he could sneak out at will. Our parents spent quite a bit on lawyers to keep him out of juvenile hall and replaced quite a few cars that he totaled. Although argumentative and opinionated, I stayed out of trouble for the most part. My brother and I were nothing like each other and nothing like our parents. It felt like four strangers living in the same house. We loved each other, there was no doubt, but we just didn't fit. I was a porcupine full of feelings with no place for my quills. Goodbyes were especially difficult for me. I figured feeling like I didn't belong was just normal, so I never dwelled on it. I certainly never let it stop me from living my life. I had lots of friend groups related to my hobbies in addition to youth group and the neighborhood kids we would play kick the can and spin the bottle with. Our family didn't talk about the trouble happening when my brother started acting out. Although he was seeing a shrink, I was not privy to any details. When the real trouble began, I was away at college. Later, when I flunked out of Bowling Green State University, my parents were so mad at me that the focus on my brother shifted for a bit, and I became the one who was embarrassing the family. Then my dad got cancer, and the focus shifted yet again. My father was an only child, so the only family we interacted with was my mom's side, and they were all pretty much cut from the same cloth. High energy, type A, rigid, but fun-loving. My mom visibly changed into somebody else when she would visit her family. There was an ongoing competition between my mom and aunt. They liked to come up, one-up each other with embarrassing stories about their kids. I can still hear them laughing like hyenas while a blanket of shame covered me. Scott and I were regularly compared to whatever our cousins were doing, which was usually bigger and better than anything we could ever do. I plotted to run away a few times because of this. During the summer, my parents and aunt and uncle would basically trade kids. The girls would stay in New York and the boys would stay in Ohio. My aunt and uncle were stricter than my parents. Sometimes I would butt heads with my Greek uncle. He didn't have a lot of patience for my inquisitive nature and was a strict and controlling presence, so different than my passive father. He did have a much better sense of humor than Max. I learned at a young age to never trust an adult who didn't care about an animal's welfare. Great Aunt Nellie was a big-boned, heavy-set, tall woman I recall our family visiting a few times. I did not like her energy and never felt safe in her presence. Once, when our families were on vacation together at Chincoteague Island, Virginia, I found a kitten outside our rental house whose eyes were matted shut and needed medical care. I wanted to take her home, but Nellie would not allow the kitten into our rental unit. My mother did not stand up to her, and I did not dare question her. So the kitten stayed outside. By the time we packed up to go home, the kitten was gone. My mom was a natural cat lover. We had two cats named Sneaker and Snooper. Snooper, which my parents had since she was a kitten, was a white, long-haired, aloof pet who did not enjoy being held or bothered. But Sneaker was the opposite and had something in common with me. She had a mysterious background. A female gray tiger-striped cat with green eyes, she got her name after crawling in our cousin's car trunk and fortunately surviving the journey from wherever she lived before she landed in our laps and hearts. That cat was so friendly, she allowed me to dress her in doll clothes. She was my soulmate growing up. My love and concern for animals ran deep. I remember crying if I saw an animal lying dead on the highway. Nobody else seemed to react this way. I figured there was something wrong with me for feeling so deeply about everything. My family treated negative feelings as if they just didn't exist, so I learned early I was alone with the unapproved of feelings. I have no memories of discussion or any consolation by my parents when our cats died. I do remember the first boy who dumped me over the Christmas holidays. I was laying in bed, devastated, refusing to eat. I recalled feeling so alone in my pain. I have always felt this way.